you have to make mistakes, because that's the sort of edge of your seat drama that being in a band should be.
But I understand why people have terrible drug problems and alcohol problems, because a lot of the entertainment industry is finding out it's nothing like you thought it would be.
I had my battles with record companies back in the 80s and won the right to make the records I wanted.
I spent 10 years of my life with no money. Trying to get a record deal was so I was my own boss and I could do what I want.
Because you're altering the DNA of everything you've been listening to, altering it, bringing it up to date, modifying it, and turning it into a kind of higher art form.
I mean, we're all expected to be videographers and influencers and all of this at the same time, and I'm not any of those. I'm a songwriter.
For every Coldplay, there's 10 other Coldplays that all got signed in the same year. You know, yeah, there's a lot of broken dreams in the business.
I was nowhere. You know, I'd lost my record deal, massively in debt, and no obvious signs that I would ever be able to recover that, you know, because the career looked to be pretty much finished.
I was terribly ambitious, really, both in terms of getting on Top of the Pops, but also in terms of getting my vision to come true.
There is no formula to having a hit record. It happens, and it's probably 60% luck, 30% talent, and 10% timing.
Making a hit record is tough, but maintaining success is another skill entirely. On The Art of Longevity, we explore the artist's experience of the music business from the inside. I want to find out what separates those artists and bands that have survived decades in the music business from all those who've fallen by the wayside. We follow a narrative inspired by a quote from Brett Anderson of Suede, who said that all successful artists have followed a similar career arc, like stations of the cross. The struggle, success, excess, disintegration, and if you're lucky, enlightenment. With insights and stories for music fans, aspiring musicians, and creators, this is The Art of Longevity. The Art of Longevity is presented with Bowers & Wilkins, the revered British premium audio brand. Ricky Lee Jones, welcome to The Art of Longevity.
Thank you. I've been at it a while.
How are you, Ricky Lee, and whereabouts in the world are you today?
New Orleans. I'm good.
I haven't been to New Orleans for about 20 years, I think. What are the changes you've seen since you moved there?
The price of real estate is really going up, and a lot of people from out of town, you know, artist types or rich hipster types, bringing in a lot of cash. And that's not a terrible thing. You should be able to live where you want. But from my view, what that does is alters the character in subtle ways. So here in the South, people are very friendly, right? I mean, everybody. Hey, how you doing? Hello, Miss Ricky. If they don't know you, they still nod at you and say hello. Well, the folks from out of town aren't like that. So then you have these new people who are like LA, and they don't look at you. And you go, ah. So they're beginning to change the character, the quaint, sweet character. There's no infrastructure here. So like the roads are really bad. The schools are bad. There aren't many policemen. So when the cost of real estate, I mean, you asked, so I'm answering. So when the cost of real estate goes up inordinately with nothing to support that, then it's going to fall back down. You know, eventually they'll take their cash and leave. So in a way, it could be good because maybe some neighborhoods will be inadvertently saved from Airbnbs. But, well, we'll see anyway.
Yeah, it's not an untypical story in terms of what's happening to neighborhoods all over the world. Well, Ricky Lee, congrats on Pieces of Treasure. That's your new record, which is going to be released pretty much as we release this episode. Your music, though, has always been, right from the beginning, post-genre. It's always been eclectic, but somehow jazz it comes back around to jazz, or the jazz side of life, as you described it. Just tell me a bit about the genesis of the record. What made you finally get around to making a record like this? Because it seems like a natural step for you.
I think it wouldn't have happened if it wasn't Russ Titelman's idea and a way to reunite with him a little more than a year ago. He really wanted to do this jazz record. And I think that it was a point of honor with him. I think he felt that it's a thing I do so well and hadn't been acknowledged for, hadn't done a really, not that I haven't done great renditions of jazz, but the records were always eclectic, so I hadn't done a really great jazz record. And I had kind of hoped to start on a new record of my compositions, but he was like, nope, we got to do this one first. So that's the genesis of how that happened.
It feels to me like it's more than a jazz record, though, because there's something really emotional about it. It's very close to the nerve. Could you only do this after you'd written your memoirs, Last Chance Texaco? If Russ would have approached you, you know, 5 or 6 years ago, could you have done it?
You know, the first thing I was going to say was I didn't really see that the memoir would affect that. But when I think of it in actual time before completing that, you're probably right on the mark. There was a sense of relief and accomplishment. The depth of what I experienced finishing the memoir, I haven't really been able to explain, but it kind of dropped me off here and now, at this age, in this place now, with so much joie de vie and so much excitement to get things done. And before I finished that book, I was burdened by all the stories and all the past for many reasons, you know, carried grudges or, you know, on behalf of family as myself. And once I told the story, yeah, I was free to do anything. And then another thing happened. Maybe this is what's happening to me in life now, but then once I made the record, as I was singing, I began to change again. I began to shed again fears, so that when it was done, I was like, I am 68 years old and you cannot scare me anymore. I know exactly who I am and what I do. And there's a little bit of claiming age as a woman that's so empowering. And until you do that, you live in fear of people finding out you're not, you know, you're flawed as far as how people view age or whatever. So I recognize that there was a certain power in claiming age. And I think I'd always been trying to do it. But once I found this voice as I sang these songs, and she's so intact, and yeah, I can feel she's her age, but there's no the way we pigeonhole people according to age. So there's none of that in that personality who's singing that music. She, and forgive me for calling her a she, but I kind of experience it theatrically, like the actor in me creates this character, and that character knows just what she's doing. And there was a different voice for this music than I'd ever sung jazz before. It's lower, and it's funny, and it's really intimate. And I think before I was really involved in just listening and controlling the texture and timbre of the voice. But something happened now where I was just totally engaged with the vowel sounds and the music and the players. I finally arrived at the here and now, and this record is what happened.
Yeah, that's nicely put, because it feels like there's all the gamut of emotions is on the record, because I know, you know, it was emotionally tough to do at times. We maybe come on to some of the songs in a moment, but it's also playful and it comes across playful. So listening to it, it takes you on that kind of emotional journey, which I love.
it's a mistake to think that because tears are falling that you're sad. The depth of feeling, and it's not that it's overwhelming, it's just wonderful. So, you know, this body goes, I'm weeping. And I'm weeping on behalf of the lyric, but I'm also overwhelmed by the feeling of making a sound. You know, it's just quite fantastic. And I've often been overwhelmed by a particular, you know, emotion at the like at the end of cycles. I'll make it, but please just don't ask me how. It's like, oh my God.
Yeah.
But this was more of an immersion in feeling, you know, neither terribly sad or, you know what I mean? So at the end of All in the Game, when in the lyric, finally the writer is promising it will be this way, but it may not. And he says he'll come back and kiss your lips. Ah, so I can't even recite it. It's so present. I just love feeling all these wonderful things. And every time you sing the song, you can go right back to that house of feeling. And it's a safe and wonderful place to explore that. That's the fun of music for me.
The Art of Longevity is presented with Bowers & Wilkins, the revered British premium audio brand. Bowers & Wilkins makes some of the world's finest audio products, from the iconic 800 series loudspeakers, trusted by Abbey Road Studios for over 40 years, to the flagship PX8 wireless headphones. This is music as the artist intended you to hear it. Okay, so tell me about the curation process, because this is a particular set of songs from, if you talk about the American Songbook and everything that's there, it's huge, it's limitless. So how did you go about whittling it down to this collection?
Well, for a couple months, after we had that lunch, we began to exchange song ideas. I had a song I knew I wanted to do just in time. He knew he wanted me to try Here's That Rainy Day. You know, he wasn't that hot for All in the Game. I had All the Way on the list, but as we went, I started to think this one isn't going to make it. It's so dramatic, and the rest of them are kind of storyteller, you know, stories, where this one is just, I don't even know what it is. We had a list of maybe over 15 songs, which we did record, and recorded some of those songs. The difficult ones are the ones that get recorded more than once. And once that's happening, you know, you're probably not going to get it. The great songs are recorded once or twice, bam, bam, and you know you got them. So ultimately, we had 10 perfect songs, 9 perfect songs. And we're not sure what to do with It Never Entered My Mind, which had been on an imaginary list 4 or 5 years ago, because I had done it 3 different ways trying to find it. You know, I'd done one with the band, one by myself, and this was the only song that had so much Ricky stamp in it and less jazz band stamp, you know, because my stuff is just very so odd and personal. And I determined not to put it on because it would change the overall feeling of the record. Let's keep it this thing, this vein that we hit that's kind of upbeat and funny and grown up. So we did that. And then once we mastered and listened again to it, oh my God, actually, that was really very good. So it'll be a... We'll release all 3 versions, but I do think the record's perfect. It's a little short, but I think it should be short. I don't, the thing of more food, more music is a bad way to go when you're making art.
Absolutely. And that's the world we're in. It's like just volume and this insatiable appetite. But I think those versions come in handy in that sense. You know, you should definitely get them out there. So let's talk about a couple of songs. So one of Ross's choices was Here's That Rainy Day. I mean, I could be wrong, but it feels like it's one of the lesser known Sinatra tracks from the Capitol years. It's not from, you know, the big albums. It's from one of the later albums.
Yeah, yeah.
From No One Cares. And there's a passage in there which is really interesting. So it's 8 bars of just instrumental.
That's right.
And yeah, you're kind of taken by surprise because after 4 bars, you think, what's going to happen next? And nothing happens next. It just plays, but it's so beautiful. So I haven't come across a song that does that ever, I don't think. There probably is one, but I can't think of one.
I'm so glad that you're the second person that mentioned that. So we left space for an instrumental. We tried a few people, but it felt like you'd put an instrument and it just didn't feel natural. There are so many great solos. Why force a solo on what is already so perfect? And it's a conversation between that quietude and the singer. So we made the choice. We love it like it is. And thanks for noticing that. Yeah.
You've always worked with phenomenal players. Tell me a little bit about this group of players on this record.
Again, this is the choice of the producer. And this is what's wonderful about having a real producer is they know who to hire to make a thing happen. And not just great players, because it's a town full of great players, but who can play with a singer and who can play with me? And I just want to mention this because it was unexpected. I'm not sure what happened in my life to put me in a defensive place when it comes to musicians, but I wasn't expecting any love at all from anybody. And when I came in, I don't even know if I'd started singing yet. Maybe I did, but in the break, the young drummer came over and Russell Malone on the guitar, and they said one at a time what an honor it was for them to be playing with me. And it made me feel so whole and ready to do my job, you know. And because it's been a hard journey. And I placed myself in front of people who were disrespectful, and it affected the work that I did. So he picked people that I don't think they were buttering me up. I think they sincerely were like, wow, Ricky Lee Jones. I haven't gotten a wow, Ricky Lee Jones, in many years. And it's amazing what it did for my confidence. And that's the truth, you know. Yeah. You can knock me right down with a word or pick me right up.
You're only human like the rest of us. But I get it. You can kind of forget who you are and what you've done. Before I came into this interview, I had 2 shots of vodka at the bar downstairs because I'm like, I'm interviewing Ricky Lee Jones. So, you know, there is an element of that. Okay, so some of these songs seem to choose themselves. So Nature Boy, September Song, Sunny Side of the Street. These are songs that your father taught you and sang to you.
Yeah.
So tell me about what memories came back when you were recording these and how they ended up in the music.
Well, Sunny Side of the Street, you know, I think it was a song I actually used, Bye Bye Blackbird and Sunny Side of the Street, to audition for the Lou King show when I was 8 or 9. And the piano player, you know, so it was da da da. Da 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 da. It was, you know, a big swing in the way they would have done it. And so when I went to do it, I thought, to tell the emotional history of the song for me. And the way to do that is to tell it very slowly, like I'm you and me talking. And so if it's just me and the guitar player, then I can fill it with all that. I don't know why, but when you slow a thing way down, especially a thing people that's usually fast, and people hear it in a different way for the first time, they'll experience their own history with the song or their own history with whatever. And I find it a fun and effective way for me to tell a true story with the song. So slowing it down, which I had only thought of doing but hadn't done with that guitar player, who was playing a lot. Even when we're doing things rubato, I feel a pulse more or less. So I'm going to, you know, so the dynamic of what's happening there is that I don't know this guy. I haven't played with him much. He's got his own set of nerves. I've got mine. He has his own thing he wants to say on his guitar. Is he listening to me or is he just playing his guitar? And all these things are happening where I'm going, ah. And then when it was done, it was perfect. I like all that drama that's happening. If you know everything beforehand, and it's wonderful to play with people year after year, but if you throw yourself in with somebody who's a little different and you both stay on your feet and dance through the thing, I have a moment in that song that's turning out to be one of my favorite moments in anything I recorded. It's so unaffected. He's playing a instrumental. Da-da-da-da, and I go, la, 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 la. I was like, who are you? Who is that lady going, la, la, la? And I love that moment very much, yeah.
This is where it really is a jazz record, because there's a conversation going on between you and the musicians throughout, I think. I wanted to ask you about One for My Baby, because yesterday it was International Women's Day, and there was a lot of stuff came out about women in music and their journey through the music industry, which if we have time for, maybe we come back to. But it's another Sinatra song, and I feel like when you try and do a Sinatra song, you kind of take on Sinatra, and that's, I would imagine, quite a daunting thing. But the way you did it was to discover it was originally by Ida Lupino.
Yeah. She's quite a dynamo herself. I believe, I should look it up first, but I think she's one of the first women to own her own stuff, to become a producer and a power player herself in 1950s Hollywood. But I saw her playing the piano to what would have been like a couple of young kids at the time, right? So, and her character, the character of a woman talking to the bartender, being kind of tough. And as the teenager watched it, she was like, wow. So I got it all. I went, oh, this girl is like a cool, young, bright spark in the middle of all these men in this fictional movie. But that part is real. And I went, that's the part I'm going to use to build a new interpretation of the song, because he owns it. You know, the main thing about Sinatra is poor me. It's after hours and poor me. That day left again, let's get drunk. We pour sobs, right? But she's got a little bit of humor and power. And, you know, buddy, you'd never know it, but I'm kind of a poet. And so the humor and the not poor me was what I tried to lean on more when I did it.
Yeah. I think, which is great to hear, because it sort of is the masculine and the feminine version of it in a sense. Thanks for listening to The Art of Longevity. I hope you're enjoying the conversation so far. Please take a moment to rate the show, leave a review on Apple Podcasts if that's where you listen, and do spread the word. Also, you can sign up via the Song Sommelier webpage for our newsletter, artwork, and much more. Back to the conversation. Let's go back in the career a little bit, if you don't mind. So your first two albums were so definitive in your career. That's the industry's narrative, not necessarily yours, maybe. It feels like this current project was a return to that time. So you're working with Russ Titelman, you've written your memoirs, so much of it was focused on those early years. I'm kind of interested in, again, how long it took you before you could comfortably go back there and enjoy looking back at those incredible early couple of records that you made.
Well, I want to address the sense and the feeling that you're talking about that I had, that there's a connection to the early years somehow in this. And I think that that's the inexplicable thing. It's harder to say, even though everyone might be feeling it, how do you say, because it's just a collection of songs, and but there's something powerful about it. There's something confident. There's something, whatever it also, on a practical thing, whatever the rapport is that I have with Tidelman, that's really palpable when we're together. We are our best selves when we're together, and it shows up in the music. So that's real, but it also, and I cross my fingers a little when I say this, but I think that a career is a cyclical thing in popular culture. And, you know, we're just getting started in rock music. It's only, 60 years old, but it seems as if, and my part in this was so iconic so quickly, and then people have to ingest if they really believe that, and does that translate to a next generation, and then another, and another, what does it mean? So, but as far as respect, it goes to total. So however high you are, you're going to go exactly that low. And if you give up, that's where your career will end. If you keep fighting, then, you're in the... And I'm talking both about practical clubs, but also how people perceive you. You're in the lower echelon of, she was okay, but what, she had one hit. It's like Rick James, right? And then you just keep circling around. There are people who go, what are you talking about? She's a writer. Yeah, she had it. And then finally, it seems as if, and maybe it's all in your own mind, but yeah, I accept my place in the world. I love that I have a career. I know what I do. And people's perception of it depends on what article they've read. So I made a mistake in reacting to those things, because they only, they have 2 minutes in their day to read what they read based on what's happening in their lives. They come to these. So all you can do is be a human being who loves your life. And if you can do that, people will come, be healed, be joyful, go back home and not hit their dog and maybe have a bad day. That's the job. And so I feel like maybe the big cycle of my career has come back to a place, and I know you're maybe not supposed to say that out loud, but of some respect, that's the guys coming up and saying, it's really an honor to be playing with you. Whereas 10 years ago, it just wouldn't have happened. And I was the same woman doing the same work, but there is this spirit that is humanity, and it's just not always, sometimes you got to walk through the fire inexplicably. Yeah, don't you find? I do.
Ricky Lee, that's why I wanted to do this show. That's why it's called The Art of Longevity. And you said it in your book, actually, careers breathe just like we breathe. And, there are good times and bad times, and there are good years, bad years, and, decades the same. I'm interested in, though, to explore this, because reading your book, you knew this at the very beginning, and you went through the struggle to get your break. I mean, you went through actually years of abject poverty when you left home as a teenager, but you somehow knew that you were going to get your break. So there was a sort of destiny calling aspect of your career. But you knew at the beginning. So just a quote from your book, you said, "I was aware before I even made a record of the dangers of being used up too fast. There is a frenzy that happens in the music world." So you had an awareness at the very beginning. How has that helped you throughout? Because there have been some ups and downs over the last four decades.
Well, when I was a kid, just barely hopeful of ever having a real career and watching who got on the cover of the Rolling Stone and snubbing my nose at the elitism of it all. I was also carefully watching how careers were almost built and died suddenly. It seemed like back then you had a 3-record career. If your first record was big, you will die a terrible death. it was better to build up to the third record when everybody celebrated you, and then you could have a long career. In my case, it wasn't just a big success. It was much bigger. So there was a possibility at that level that I could throw some bridges and be maybe like, I hope, Sinatra. Maybe in the 1950s, you know, 15 years after my big success, I'd still be working. It'd be hard. So I had a plan from the very beginning of how to wrangle whatever happened. And that in the worst case scenario, if I had to be what they used to call a cult, right? A cult artist. Well, then you'd have a fierce and small group, but you'd still be able to work in music and not in the laundry room at the hotel. So it's a matter of perspective, right?
Yeah, totally. And, you know, I work with a lot of new artists that are up and coming now, rising artists, trying to get their break. I mean, it's never going to be like the break that you had. Yeah, it's completely different. But in a way, the discussion we have is that what is the goal? And actually, the goal when it comes down to it is to have a career and be a cult artist. You end up there anyway if you started out when you started out, so you may as well just settle for it, in a sense.
So when you say a cult artist, you think they're thinking a manageable but fierce group of people who will stay with you for a lifetime.
Exactly. That fan base that's there for you, yeah, through thick and thin. I think I bought all your records from, I mean, like The Evening of My Best Day, I think, is probably where I actually rediscovered your music. But then looking back just before that, you had that sort of classic experience as an established artist from your time. So you released records that were always critically revered or really well received by critics through the 90s, Pop Pop, Traffic from Paradise, and Ghost Ahead, but they just kept on selling less. How did you get through that time?
That was hard. And that's part of what I'm talking about. I maybe that's in my mind, but I just thought, maybe this is payment for so much success so fast that you have to suffer making the best work you can, but nobody's going to look at it. Just hang on. It's some kind, you know, I grew up Catholic, so it's some kind of moral, you know, debt that you owe for having so much glory so soon. But I also think the emphasis is in the word popular. Popular music, popular singer. So, you know, it's a kid's game. And there are many, many, many other young people who come up who are the popular artists. The thing is to teach the audience that you're not a pop singer, that you're as an artist, a musician. And everybody wants, like you said, cult artists. They want to know where to put you, so they can decide if you're part of how they see themselves. I think that it was that complicated thing of Ricky Lee Jones is a pop singer or a rock singer or a, you know, she's big. And now that we don't hear about her, she must not be very good.
Yeah,
and we're not even gonna go buy the thing because she's just probably not very good now. There are musicians or musician journalists who'll check out what you're doing just because that's what they like to do. There's a small group of fans who want to go with me on my journey, even though I'm taking a lot of turns from where I began. And they're like, yeah, I like Chucky's in Love, but I really hate this ghosty thing, but I'm going to stay with you. So it took a fierce kind of, and I picked up new kids with Ghosty Head. I lost some old fans, and that was, I wasn't really sure why, but ultimately, I think what I've done is kind of dig my own genre and go, here's the singer-songwriter genre that creates different kinds of music every time. Unlike Joni Mitchell, who makes this kind of record each time, and you can count on it. You don't know what Ricky's going to do. I have the same voice, yes, but what she is working with a banjo player now? What's she doing? So, but I think now after 40 years or 45 years, I'm hoping anyway, that there are other singer-songwriters who do the same thing, who explore different ideas. And what's consistent about their work is their heart, their compassion, their kindness that comes through in everything they do. That's what I hope. When I'm gone, that will be the trail I left behind.
So coming through to how you got through the other side of that, because you were put on such a pedestal at the beginning, and you were on major labels for so long, like those 90s records were also released on major labels, which come with big expectations and attachments always. By the time you got to, I'm thinking of 2015, The Other Side of Desire, which has got some songs on it that I really love, Infinity in particular, I really love that song. That was crowdfunded, wasn't it? I mean, I just found that extraordinary to look at the career of Ricky Lee Jones. You crowdfunded an album. How did it feel to be in that place at that time?
That was risky. You know, I was broke and I really didn't have the money to make a record. And, you know, there have been some years recently where I couldn't get a label to take me on either. So, but if they did, they're offering so little money that in the end, I'd almost lose money. So I thought, if we crowdfund it, maybe I can, you know, make $20,000 or $30,000 at the end of the day. And we must talk about money because, you know, we're in the business of music. But it was risky because what if nobody shows up to my party? What if we don't reach our goal? And in fact, we did have to readjust the goal because the manager was going, we just can't look like we didn't reach our meager goal. So it's okay. It's just a journey. And there ultimately there were people there who helped to fund the record. And the problem is that unlike working with Russ Titelman, you're not in a spiritual position of power. I did want to learn humility. I really felt that was an important part of my lesson on earth. But humility doesn't help an artist manifest their person, their persona. It just doesn't, you know. If you're too meek and you can't open up your arms. So, you know, it's just been a journey of a human being going, I feel like I'm too self-important. I need to learn to be humble. Oh, well, that wasn't a good idea because I couldn't do the best record I could. You know, it's just me learning as I am making do because I no longer had. I think that I'm at my best when I have enough money to work and really positive and loving attention. I can go to higher places with that. And without it, I don't. I wish I could say that I'm self-perpetuating and it doesn't matter what circumstance I'm in, but it really, really did. I know a lot of people look back at their work and like me go, oh, I could have done that better. But the main thing I would have liked to have done with them is just change the keys. Because I think I was kind of depressed. So everything that I sang is very low, right? But some of it, if I would have had somebody, come on, let's put it up there. You can sing that. That's going to be fantastic. Somebody going, sing Infinity a little higher and then they can hear it. Or taking my time, hurrying along. That should have been a higher thing. So I look back at that and go, bad keys. But good songs.
Well, it's really interesting to sort of hear you talk about how you've had to keep that belief because you had so much self-belief at the beginning, but then you have to keep it. I think that's where the doubt comes in is when you're not fulfilling the expectations that you had early on. And so you're going to have to ride that roller coaster.
It was really important to me to bring the old people in. And I'm glad you brought it up. I spoke with a journalist yesterday who said, I saw you in Cleveland in 1979, you opened the show with Chuck Keys in Love. And we went, what? Where's it going to go down? And then you introduced us to Dinah Washington and Billie Holiday. And by the end of the show, we not only knew you, but we knew them. It was like, that's exactly what I wanted to do. I did Lush Live and My Funny Valentine. And in 1979, if you can imagine it, it's disco, Farrah Fawcett. It's so different than it is now. And people were really not interested in the music of 25 years earlier, which would have been Sinatra and the rhythm and blues jazz kind of thing. And I was determined, first, I liked singing it and wanted the world to know it was part of what I did, but I was determined that people would hear it. And I just wanted to say that to you, that that was part of my, as a kid, that was part of my mission, not only to sing jazz, but for those people who'd never heard it, to hear it.
The Art of Longevity is brought to you by the Song Sommelier, that's me, working with Project Melody and Audio Culture. It's recorded at The Cube, London's first members studio for content creators. Currently based in West London, Cube will be opening a second site in Canary Wharf in January 2023. Our cover art is by Mick Clark, and original music for the podcast is by the neoclassical composer and artist Andrew James Johnson. Just coming back to now then with Pieces of Treasure, there's something in there which you recognise that you'd always, to some extent, your career was a vessel for the classics, I think. Yeah, we talked about Sinatra. You cover Nat King Cole on Pieces of Treasure. I mean, those early songs felt like they were from the American Songbook in a way, you know, so you've kept the lineage of Gershwin and Sondheim and, you know, your first inspiration was West Side Story. I'm interested, like, how do you think that's going to continue in music? Who's taking that lineage forward?
You know, I'm not very educated with young people. For music to get to me, you know, it has to have something resoundingly emotional in it. My manager manages a band called Lake Street Dive, and the singer in it is, you know, not that her tone is like me at all, but I can tell that she has educated herself in a wide variety of jazzy music and this and that. So when I hear her, I can have respect because I know she comes to the stage not imitating anybody, not trying to do tricks, just letting us hear the timbre of her voice. I think there's a trad jazz fire that's burning here in New Orleans. Kids love to play the 30s and 20s songs. So if it is continued, it's going to continue in a grassroots way where people actually hear the songs and love them and sing them themselves.
I think it comes back around. I sense there's definitely a flight to those classic years, actually, the late 70s, early 80s. I didn't know Lake Street Dive, actually, but thanks for introducing them to me. But on this show, I've had the DeLines, who are amazing. But then I think about artists like Lana Del Rey, even Harry Styles. They want to make those classic records that were made in the late 70s. And I get it.
Oh. Gee, are they attracted to the country, folky, rock kind of thing of it? Or what is it you think that calls them to it?
It's the classicism of it. It's the album, the narrative, the fact that you got absorbed with a side one and a side two, and they want to feel like they, you know, make a mark in that way. You know, as you did with Ricky Lee Jones and Pirates, you did it.
Yeah, that's great.
So the other thing that's come back around recently is spoken word lyrics, which you've been a natural at since the beginning. Do you think scat singing will make a comeback?
Sure, why wouldn't it? If people haven't done it, then a new generation can go, here's something we can claim as our own. So, yeah.
Ricky Lee, I got a whole bunch of other questions, but I don't want to keep you much longer. I'm just interested in what's next for you. What are you excited about when you get the record out and you maybe take it live, just over the next sort of year or two, what are you looking forward to the most?
I hope I can stand in front of really large audiences that aren't necessarily familiar with me and sing to them. So that old and new, young and old, that I can place myself before people like in the very beginning and let them hear for themselves what it is, feel for themselves what it is I need. I would really like that to happen in the next year.
Are you coming to the UK or Europe?
We are. I think we're going to go ahead and come to Glastonbury. That they are the only festival and say, Rick and Lee, come on down. I don't know if we can, if we're allowed to play in London, if we play there, but hopefully play in London then.
I'll be there at the front row if you take this record live. So thanks very much for joining me. And I wish you all the best, Ricky Lee.
Thank you so much. It was really an unexpected pleasure to talk about the work.
Fantastic. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
See you soon.